This is Intelligence Matters, sponsored by Flare, a leader in providing actionable cyber threat intelligence to companies and governments around the world.
Mike Vickers was the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence under President Obama. He is a former CIA officer and a former Special Forces officer. He joins us today to talk about his recent book, By All Means Available, Memoirs of a Life in Intelligence, Special Operations, and Strategy. We will be right back with that discussion after a quick break. I'm Michael Morrell, and this is Intelligence Matters. The lines between geopolitical risk and cyber risk are blurring. Flare is a next-generation, continuous threat exposure management SaaS platform that equips corporate information security teams with world-class collection and continuous monitoring across dark web cybercrime forums, markets, Telegram channels, and sources of geopolitical risk. Flare sets up in 30 minutes, creates actionable intelligence from hour one, and is used by governments, security teams, and threat intelligence teams around the world. You can try Flare's free trial at their website, Flare.io. That's Flare.io. Mike, welcome to the show. It's great to have you back on Intelligence Matters.
It's great to be with you, Michael.
So congratulations on your book, By All Means Available, Memoirs of a Life in Intelligence, Special Operations, and Strategy. I'm sure you're happy that it's published and all of the work is done.
Yeah, indeed I am.
Mike, perhaps I can start by asking you to describe the book, its story arc, and its overarching theme.
Sure. So it traces my evolution from an operator to a national security policymaker and intelligence community leader over some four decades, beginning as a Green Beret or Special Forces soldier in the Cold War in the 1970s, and then as a Special Forces officer, then CIA operations officer, and then Assistant Secretary of Defense under President George W. Bush and Barack Obama for Special Operations, Low Intensity Conflict, and Interdependent Capabilities, where I had oversight from everything from nuclear weapons down to Special Operations. And then finally, Under Secretary of Defense for Intelligence, where we worked very closely together. And what I try to show in the book is why some strategies were very successful, defeating the Soviets in Afghanistan, dismantling and largely defeating Al-Qaeda around the world, and the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, and then why others weren't so successful. And I introduce concepts about escalation dominance and other strategic approaches that I think are more successful than others.
The title of the book, though, kind of gets at the fundamental theme, right? Which is, if you want to accomplish something, bring everything you have to bear. Is that fair?
It's mostly fair in a sense. The title comes from a then top secret National Security Decision Directive President Reagan signed that directed us to drive the Soviets out of Afghanistan by all means available. So scale is important, but so is speed, but also is having not just all available means, but the right means and the right strategy, the right ways, as we say, and realistic ends. And so I try to address those other parts. So it doesn't necessarily mean overwhelming force, it means decisive force and figuring out what that is. And so a good example of that is the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. You know, there were options to send in large numbers of troops. President Bush wisely decided, I think, to support the then very small Afghan resistance to the Taliban with special forces and CIA advisors, but backed up by U.S. air power. And U.S. Mm-hmm. air power really provided that decisive element for local ground troops. Predator campaigns against Al-Qaeda are a similar example. You know, it's not the largest air power we can, or the heaviest quantity of air, massive air power we could use, but it was perfectly tailored to that situation, and it helped defeat Al-Qaeda.
You know, one of the things, Mike, that struck me about your book is, you know, it's not only a book about your experiences and what you did, it's also a history book. It really, really does an amazing job, I think, of walking through the history of the issues you were involved in, you know, the context around all of that from both an intelligence perspective and a policy perspective. So it's actually a book that I will, you know, keep on my shelf, not only because you're my friend, but because if I want to know something about some aspect of the CIA program in Afghanistan to drive the Soviets out, I can go to your book and I can find that out. So I think it's a, you know, terrific book, both from the perspective of, you know, your own experiences, the history of the issues, and then the lessons that you learned. So, you know, huge congratulations on doing all of that. I want to ask, you know, a couple of questions, you know, throughout your career here, and maybe we can start during your time as in the Special Forces. And I want to ask you about a incident you had in free fall training.
Sure. So one of the clandestine infiltration techniques for Special Forces and other special operators is military free fall, or very high altitude skydiving, and then falling, you know, several miles and then opening your parachute. And I went to this training at one point, and you know, today when we teach this, we teach people how to get stable in wind tunnels first, you know, so they learn their body position. And, you know, now civilians, there's recreational wind tunnels and things you can go try out, simulated skydiving. In my day, they taught us the correct body positions on a table, you know, lying down and arching your back and balancing your arms and legs. And then they took us up to 12,500 feet and threw us out of an airplane and see how we did. And I did well on my first jump, which we call Hollywood, which means you're just jumping with no equipment or weapon or anything, just your uniform, and got stable. And so they immediately had me jump with a rucksack and weapon, a rucksack strapped to the back of my legs. And it was filled with a sandbag. And I looked at this thing, and it was very unbalanced in how it was packed. The harness that, you know, cinched it and attached it to your parachute harness behind your legs, which I knew was going to cause me trouble. The sand was bulging out of one side of this rucksack. You know, it wasn't balanced. And so I complained to the or brought it to the attention of one of the instructors, and he said, "Oh, you'll be fine. Don't worry." And as soon as I jumped out of the airplane, I went into this violent spin. You know, the rucksack was just pulling me in the direction where the bulge was. Mm-hmm. And I fell about 8,000 feet in this spin. And one of the things you can do, and then finally I got stable on my back. And I thought, oh, good, now I'm stable. And then I thought about it for a second. And I thought, you know, I can't keep falling without looking at the ground and figuring out where I am. Right. And so I had to do a real hard arch to managed to flip over, to essentially do a somersault and get face down to the earth. And then I had to contort my body like Houdini to counteract the effect, you know, from happening all over again, counteract the effect of this rucksack. So I was twisted one way and it worked, and I landed safely on the ground. And then I went home and repacked that rucksack for my next time.
So did you pack it in the first place?
Or did somebody else pack it? It was like a line of these things, and they said, "Here, Lieutenant, take this," you know, and so I did. And I looked at it and I thought, this isn't going to work, but all right. And it sure didn't work.
That's funny. And then there's a story about backpack nukes as well that I'd love for you to tell.
Yeah, so very early in my career, first 5 years, I was in units really where we were preparing for World War III, if the Soviets invaded Europe in a massive way. And my units were all tasked in the event of war with going behind Soviet lines into Eastern Europe or the Soviet Union and doing special operations, unconventional warfare, you know, if there were resistance movements in Czechoslovakia or Hungary or Poland or elsewhere. And one of the very special capabilities we had was this thing called a special atomic demolition munition, a backpack nuclear weapon that special forces or SEALs, a select group, could either scuba in or parachute in with this thing, again, strapped to the back of your legs or front, depending on how whether you were doing static line or free fall, and received a lot of training on how to arm the thing and all the command and control that comes with nuclear weapons. But, you know, I did that when I was 23. And, you know, it seemed like an adventurous thing to do at the time, you know, not so sure anymore. But the weapons went out of service with the end of the Cold War, like a lot of tactical nuclear weapons. But it was considered a really dangerous and one-way mission. There was a timer on the darn thing, and we were never convinced that, you know, if we emplaced it and started to set the timer, that it would detonate right away, because the reason you had a timer is you had to keep overwatch. You had to get yourself in a position where you could maintain, you know, indirect control of the nuclear weapon until it was detonated. So it was a strange mission.
Mike Vickers, you are a badass.
No, I don't know about that.
So next in your career comes your time as a CIA operations officer. And as you know, one of the things that CIA is really known for is giving its newest officers, you know, responsibility from day one, right? And that's exactly what happened to you with regard to Grenada. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so I joined the CIA's career training program, which, you know, had courses spaced with on-the-job training assignments, and then, you know, training to be an operations officer. And we had a paramilitary operations course in those days. And very soon after I joined, before I had completed most of this training, I was on my first on-the-job assignment for a couple weeks. Grenada started really political situation in Grenada really started deteriorating. And there was a coup by it was a communist government, but the deputy was more radical than the leader of Grenada. And so he and the head of the armed forces did a coup and murdered the leader. And we had 600 medical students there. A lot of Americans went to the Caribbean for their medical training in those days. And so over the course of 3 days, President Reagan ordered an invasion. And I was told to come into CIA headquarters 2 days before the invasion on a Sunday. And I packed a big suitcase thinking I would be going forward to some CIA base. So I had all my suits and ties and all this thing. And as soon as I got into headquarters, they had a private plane and told me I was going to be one of the three going into Grenada with the special operators with the invasion force. And so fortunately, I had a few civilian clothes or casual clothes, but I was given a big bag of money to pay agents if we could find them. A lot of them were being held in jail at that point. And then a weapon and a satellite communications. And I went to war with a Ralph Lauren polo shirt, linen pants. And then we made it up as we went. And so that was...
All right, maybe so you're not a badass.
Yeah.
Ralph Lauren shirt.
Well, I got into combat with that outfit. When we joined a military unit and the Cubans counterattacked us. But strange way to go to war. But it really does highlight the improvisation of CIA and the ability to find talent wherever it is and then give them responsibility early.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that continued even more so after that.
Yeah. So I want to focus you know, some of our time here on your work on the Afghan Covert Action Program in the 1980s, because it was one of the times in your career where your work had, you know, strategic impact, strategic consequences. And so Mike, can you talk about why that Covert Action Program was so important? What difference did it make? And then what role you played in that effort?
Sure. So for the first five, Soviets invaded in December 1979, a deteriorating situation with their communist ally and who had done a coup 18 months earlier and triggering resistance. And right after the invasion, 3 days after, President Jimmy Carter signed a lethal finding authorizing CIA to support the Afghan resistance, and the first weapons were in the hands of the Mujahideen or Afghan resistance within 10 days of the invasion. So it was really responsive on CIA's part. But for the first 5 years of the war, from 79 to 84, Carter's last year and Reagan's first term, there was no thought that the Afghan resistance could win. And so our policy objective was just to make the Soviet occupation as costly as possible. And so the program was kind of on a steady state. It reached a budget of $60 million a year from the U.S. side, and the Saudis matched us dollar for dollar. We had a great secret coalition of the Chinese, the Saudis, Pakistanis, of course, United Kingdom, Egypt, and others. And then in 1984, a congressman from Texas, Charlie Wilson, quadrupled CIA's budget. He was on the House Defense Subcommittee on Appropriations, and CIA had asked for a 10% increase to take the program, counting the Saudi contribution, from $120 million to $132, and they got a 300% increase, which you don't see in government every day. So right at that point, as this program dramatically increased, and there was a lot of consternation in the upper leadership of CIA about this, about the size of this increase, I was given this job that combined two previous jobs as a one senior case officer who was the Afghan covert action program officer that did all the strategy and reporting to Congress and all that. And then the chief paramilitary advisor at the time was a Marine colonel detailed to CIA. And this position was several grades above where I was at the time. I had just completed training not long before, you know, all the full CIA training program. And I was given this great responsibility in South Asia operations of the Near East Division. And, you know, a series of things came together. So we started deciding how we had four big objectives. One was to shift the air balance in the insurgents' favor with lots of surface-to-air missiles and other things to enable them through training and all kinds of weapons, rockets and anti-tank weapons and mortars and others, to conduct far more sophisticated attacks, including into urban areas with demolitions, and for us to have more intelligence on the overall resistance while protecting their communications, and then to really increase their operational tempo. Operational tempo is really critical, the number of attacks you can do. That depends on ammunition and resupply routes, and or like in the Predator case with Al-Qaeda, you know, the number of aircraft you have and strikes you do. But and thinking that if we did that, we would be able to really increase the cost of the Soviets. But there were things we couldn't do within CIA. And that was, had to persuade our partners to escalate. We had to get more funding to be able to do this beyond the quadrupling we had just received. And then, of course, we needed a policy objective. And so a National Security Council review was conducted. At the end of that, President Reagan, and this is March 1985, President Reagan changed our objective from imposing costs to driving them out. So that provided kind of the hunting license. And we went back to Congress a couple months after that and said, we've worked out our strategy. We're already implementing it. If you just double our, we know you've quadrupled our budget. If you just double it from here, we think we can achieve this objective. And Congress did, taking the program up almost to $1.2 billion. So an increase of 10 in several months, in under a year. And so everything went up by the same percentage, essentially, and new things were started. So we trained 10 times the number of resistance. We provided, you know, 10 times the number of weapons and ammunition, a lot of new sophisticated things, including, you know, Western weapons. Got Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher's approval for the British blowpipe. And then a couple months later, President Reagan's for the U.S. made Stinger. So we went from having like 20 surface-to-air missile systems in Afghanistan to almost 2,000, you know, in the course of a year. So all of those things added up really increased our capability. And at the same time, Gorbachev gave his generals the direction to win the war in 2 years. And he did a surge. He increased, took his best general from East Germany and put him in charge, put 25,000 more troops in, and three quarters of the special forces, or Spetsnaz that the Soviets call them, into Afghanistan. And we had these dual escalations. And by February 86, we had won that essentially battle of the two surges. And Gorbachev started looking for the exits. And then by February 89, the last Soviet soldier was out of Afghanistan. So it's a combination of speed, scale, scope, in a sense, of the qualitative as well as quantitative adjustments. But it stemmed also from a desire to win. You know, the objective was critically important. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, because you're taking risk when you escalate, too. We were concerned about a Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. So our top analysts, the analytical directorate that you headed, was headed by Bob Gates at the time. And the White House wanted a personal assessment from him about the risk that this would trigger a Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And he had a very good argument and supported our efforts and said he didn't believe that it would. You know, Afghanistan was kind of the fourth priority for the Soviets beyond war in Europe, a war with China, and invading the Persian Gulf. So they couldn't, to escalate in Afghanistan, they would need several more 100,000 troops. To invade Pakistan on top of that, you know, even more than that. And so we were pretty confident they couldn't do it, but it wasn't without risk. And I remember telling Gates as I took the paperwork around to get all the signatures in CIA, you know, from the comptroller and the general counsel, and then Gates and his memo. And once he said, you know, that he supported this and gave me the memo, I got out of the office as fast as I could before he changed his mind and used him about that years later. And he just nonplussed.
Yeah, that's great. So there are many people who believe, right, that the Soviet defeat in Afghanistan, you know, played a role ultimately in the collapse of the Soviet Union. Do you share that view?
I do, and a number of others do as well. You know, it wasn't the only factor. Support for solidarity helped. Gorbachev's failed reforms combined with his political control that he could, you know, implement these and suppress dissent, essentially, to these reforms, you know, all played a role. The deteriorating economy, you know, and his decisions not to use force in Eastern Europe as it started breaking away. So there are a number of factors that really led to that collapse. But this was the only defeat the Red Army had suffered in its history. And so both the KGB and the Red Army were discredited more in Soviet circles after the decision to withdraw and then the withdrawal. So yes, I do think it played a significant role, but not the only role.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more of a discussion with Mike Vickers.
Beacon Global Strategies is the premier national security advisory firm. Beacon works side by side with leading companies to help them understand national security policy, geopolitical risk, global technology policy, and federal procurement trends. Beacon's insight gives business leaders the decision advantage. Founded in 2013, Beacon develops and supports the execution of bespoke strategies to mitigate business risk, drive growth, and navigate a complex geopolitical environment. With a bipartisan team and decades of experience, Beacon provides a global perspective to help clients tackle their toughest challenges.
You then left CIA at that point. Did you leave because, you know, you had just defeated the Soviet Union and, right, there wasn't a whole lot more that could top that?
Yeah, pretty much. A number, you know, I had the great fortune because of this job of working across the agency with a lot of top officials, not only in the Directorate of Operations, but science and technology and analysis and support. And a number of them told me, like, this is the best job of our careers, and we're at the end of it, you know, and you're young, and what are you going to do for the next 25 years? And it, you know, they offered me a chief of base job that was very good, again, a couple grades above where I was. But, you know, I struggled with that, thinking I didn't want to slow down. And so I thought maybe I should go to graduate school, get a little experience outside, and then come back into government as a senior official that you can do in the political system. You know, it was a half-baked plan at the time, but I thought it was a way to, you know, continue my path up without, you know, spending a lot of years kind of moving up the ranks incrementally after this. And, you know, it's one of the career decisions in my life that I still have uncertainty about. And mm-hmm. President Bush asked me about it when I was giving him some advice on Iraq. And you know, he said, why'd you leave CIA? And, you know, until 9/11, I thought that was a good decision. And then when 9/11 hit, I thought, gee, did I make the biggest mistake of my life? Where would I be right now instead? And, you know, it ended up working out fine. But, yeah. It's, you know, anyway, that was my rationale.
Yeah. Well, if somebody came into my office and said, you know, I'm going to take a break here and here's why. And, you know, you had just defeated the Soviet Union. I would totally, completely understand. But you did return to government as a senior policy official. So that plan worked out. And you, when you returned, right, in 2007, I think it was, mm-hmm. When you returned, the key issue, of course, in the aftermath of 9/11 was international terrorism, and in particular, Al-Qaeda. So, Mike, talk about the state of Al-Qaeda upon your return.
Sure. So, you know, after they were defeated and the Taliban regime was overthrown in 2001, a lot of the leadership fled to Pakistan and some to Iran, and where some remain today. And for the first 2 years after 9/11, they had largely gone to what the Pakistanis called the settled areas, or the areas east of the Indus River, where the cities are. And so in cooperating with us, the Pakistanis intelligence service, we were able to capture a number of these leaders, you know, in these urban areas, in their safe houses. And Al-Qaeda then decided to relocate to the Afghanistan-Pakistan border region, particularly the federally administered tribal areas, the seven agencies that make up the Fatah, and where they had some connections and had married into families going back to the late Soviet Afghan war, you know, when a lot of foreigners had come to Pakistan to try to help the jihad. And then they became a much more difficult target. And we had invaded Iraq, and Pakistan had, you know, and started supporting the Taliban more. A lot of things happened to change the geopolitics. But by 2005, 2006, Al-Qaeda had reconstituted enough. And in 2006, we had this transatlantic airliner plot, Al-Qaeda to blow up 12 airliners taking off from the United Kingdom to the United States. It would have been a 9/11 scale attack, and maybe worse in terms of its implications, you know, for the economy. It would have killed 3,000 plus Americans again, and or passengers, but mostly Americans. And so that started us to rethink our strategy for dealing with Al-Qaeda in this.
Let me just stop you here for a second, Mike. People don't understand what you just said, right? Is that they think in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, right, Al-Qaeda was degraded to the point where it couldn't attack America anymore. But you're making the very accurate point that they that was true, but they rebuilt that capability over time because they had found a place on the planet where they could operate, right, without significant interference.
Yeah, it's exactly.
They built the capability by 2005 in London, and by 2006, right, in the transatlantic plot, to again attack the homeland in a significant way.
Yeah, it's exactly right. And, you know, and the 2001 invasion of Afghanistan killed a lot of Al-Qaeda operatives, but it mostly displaced a lot of senior leaders. And, you know, so a number of them got away, and they got new operatives over time, and they were able to reconstitute. And, you know, one of the core principles of counter counterterrorism strategy that we really learned with the 9/11 attacks is to deny them any sanctuary. You know, that when you give these groups a couple years or so, and we saw it not only in Pakistan, but also in Yemen and Syria, the threat to the United States goes up significantly. And so between 2003 and 4 and 2007, our strategy against al-Qaeda in the Afghanistan-Pakistan border region was to essentially rely on the Pakistanis. And so we started doing a few Predator strikes or drone strikes in 2004, but only with Pakistani approval. And so there weren't many of them. And you know, and it wasn't matching the threat. And the Pakistanis had sent their army in, but then they would withdraw. And that was, and in fact, an insurgency was developing in Pakistan with the Pakistan Taliban, who were also giving shelter to al-Qaeda along with the Haqqanis and other groups. And in 2006, besides this transatlantic plot, the Pakistanis did a peace deal, essentially, with militants in North Waziristan, said, we'll leave you alone if you leave us alone. And that was al-Qaeda's, one of their two main strongholds with South Waziristan. And so al-Qaeda had even more of a sanctuary. Nobody was going to bother them. And so our strategy was failing. And President Bush realized this. And so essentially, as soon as I came into office, not because of me, but just the timing, he directed DOD and CIA and state, but mainly DOD and CIA, to come up with a new strategy to really deal with this threat. And so we did right away through a series of meetings and deputies at the National Security Council. And then Pakistan went into political turmoil. President Musharraf was being undermined by the army and then by civilian populace, particularly lawyers' revolt. And so we couldn't implement our new strategy for several months until the political situation stabilized, and it did by Musharraf going to leave office. And so in August, early August of 2008, President Bush approved this new strategy to take the fight to this border region. And I had the honor of presenting it to him along with Mike Hayden, Marty Dempsey, who was our Central Command commander at the time, and Ann Patterson, our ambassador to Pakistan. You know, they each presenting CIA's role, the military's role, and State Department's role, and I was doing the overall strategy. And it involved a number of significant things. To shift from essentially bilateral operations where the Pakistanis would approve these predator strikes to unilateral, where we would tell them right after we did the strike, to do a thing called signature strikes, where we could target more al-Qaeda leaders. We didn't have to know exactly who that leader was as long as we had high confidence that it was al-Qaeda. We expanded the target list to safe haven providers and al-Qaeda rank and file. And we put a lot more predators, you know, mass again in the region. So we could really increase the operational tempo. And as Mike Hayden has famously said, for a variety of reasons, we didn't kill one al-Qaeda high-value target in 2007 under the old strategy. And in the last few months of 2008, we took 8 top al-Qaeda high-value targets off the battlefield. And it really stunned al-Qaeda. And then one of the good things about a transition of administrations was the continuity between the Bush administration and Obama administration on this. And so for President Obama's first term, he sustained this program and even accelerated it in 2010, the operational tempo in 11. And so by 2012, al-Qaeda was pretty beaten down in this area, not completely, you know, they were closer to strategic defeat than they had. Now, it took several more years. We kind of slowed the tempo in the years after that, as you remember, before you retired in 2013. And the threat had spread to Yemen, and we had lots of other things to deal with. But by 2022, when Ayman al-Zawahiri was killed and a number of Yemeni leaders were killed the years before and some in other parts of the world, al-Qaeda was really battered.
Mike, one of the many roles you played on this issue at the time was making sure that DOD's limited number of drones were actually brought into this fight against Al-Qaeda. So you were essentially taking drones from other missions around the world and making sure they were focused on Al-Qaeda.
Sure. So one, we hardly had any at 9/11. And so we slowly started building up this capability, you know, and we're at war in Afghanistan and then Iraq, and they're in high demand. And we still don't have enough in 2006. We finally, with the big surge, had reached capacity of 65, what we call orbits, ability to sustain an aircraft 24/7 over a target area. So you need, you know, depending on the math, 2 to 3, sometimes 4 aircrafts to do that and crews accordingly and everything else. And so when we began this strategy to start going after Al-Qaeda in the Afghanistan-Pakistan border region, we only had 3 orbits there. And within a couple years, we took that up to 14 and then added 8 more for Yemen. So of the 65 that we finally had in 2011, over a third of these were dedicated to this national counterterrorism mission in areas outside of Afghanistan and Iraq. And so that was controversial because those same aircraft certainly could have helped our troops in Afghanistan and Iraq, but the threat to the American homeland, you know, we had to do all three things. Once the threat to the American homeland wasn't coming from those two places, it was you know, coming from the border region with Pakistan and then Yemen and then Syria subsequently. So we put a lot of effort you know, on that. And first Secretary Gates approved most of those, and then Secretary Panetta, when he came over from CIA, did the last couple.
So Mike, your CT work, just like mine, culminated in the Bin Laden operation. And I just want to ask for your, you know, strongest memories of the arc of your involvement in that operation.
Sure. So one was, you know, this hunt, as you know, of course, had gone on for 9 years. And before, when the strategy with the courier started working, you know, other strategies didn't work with his family members or media appearances trying to figure out where he was there.
Or his health, I think, was the other.
Yeah, and health. But, you know, it took time to first learn the nom de guerre or kunya in Arabic of the courier, and then his true name a couple years later, and then where we thought he might be. And even before we found him, we had a glimpse or two of him, but couldn't geolocate. And then finally, and you know, as you know, in late August 2010, we were able to find and fix him enough to follow him back to the compound, and then started really analyzing that compound for who might be there. And so one, I remember you briefing me and the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs in a room in the old executive office building after one of our NSC meetings. And I thought, you know, finally we got him. You know, it was just it was one of those moments you live for in a national security professional's career. And, you know, couldn't wait to get to work on it. And there were only 4 of us at the time. You know, Panetta had at the same time was briefing Secretary Gates and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And, you know, so for the first few months, we're working on the intelligence. And then you and Director Panetta asked me to come to CIA right around Christmas time to start working on operational options. And that's the first time, you know, I couldn't wait for the holidays to be over and get back to work. And
I think that's when we brought Bill McRaven in, too.
And then a month later, we brought Bill McRaven in and showed him what we had, and then, you know, started developing things. And, you know, we had 5 meetings with the president, and there are 2 that really stick out in my mind. The first one we had where we briefed him on the intelligence and then our initial operational options for him to consider. And he said, as President Obama, you know, he said, well, if we're going to do this, we're going to do it sooner rather than later, and we're going to do it unilaterally, because we had options with the Pakistanis, and we had air options, ground options, unilateral, bilateral, and you know, the hair on the back of my neck stood up, and I thought, we're really going to do this. You know, he didn't make a decision then, but first meeting, I didn't expect anything like that from him.
Yeah.
And then as we got closer to it, you know, the intelligence was very strong, but it was circumstantial. You know, there was no smoking gun that he was there, that Bin Laden was there. And I remember the meeting you and I were at, where they went around the room and asked us what percentage we applied to Bin Laden being there based on this evidence. And, you know, and they ranged from 80 some percent. I was a little on the higher side, and I think 50 or 60 on the lowest side. Most, you know, were positive, but I'll never forget when you said, I put it at 60%. And actually, you know, I had lived through Iraq's weapons of mass destruction case, and at the time that seemed like a stronger case. And you could have heard a pin drop in the room at that point. And I thought, oh man, our best analyst, you know, who they're going to listen to, has just said, you know, 60% in comparison with Iraq. And Obama said 60% still really good, you know, and thank you.
He followed that up. He immediately followed that up, right, by asking me, Michael, does
that you do it?
Do this, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I said, can. No, I'd absolutely do this.
Yes, yes. And that was critical, right? So I remember the pin drop, but I also remember that. And then that just calmed the waters. And Obama came to the same conclusion. Look, he said he was at 50%, but 50% American people would expect us to do this. And, you know, and I heard him say that over and over. And then, you know, the final thing, I guess, was coming out of the White House when we were done. You know, you and I were a couple of the briefers on background after the president gave his speech to the nation on the intelligence and
yeah, we were backgrounding the media. Yeah.
Backgrounding the media. And coming out of CIA, you know, we had been at CIA that afternoon for the command and control. And so my car was there. And coming out of the White House at 2 a.m. and hearing all those college students around chanting USA, USA, and then CIA, CIA, I thought, I'm never going to hear this again in my life. So I'm just going to enjoy it for a second or two. And, you know, that's the big memories. But it was, you know, getting him really just felt a sense of closure for the American people and, you know, that we had done our job.
Yeah, for sure. Mike, there are a ton of more things that I wanted to ask you about, right? The end of your book does a great job of going through the national security threats and challenges of today, right? And applying the lessons learned. Mm-hmm. So we don't have time to get into all that today, but I want you to come back, you know, early next year, and we'll go through the current issues of the day and the application of your lessons learned to those. So the book is, by all means available, Memoirs of a Life in Intelligence, Special Operations, and Strategy. The author is my friend, Mike Vickers. Mike, many, many thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much, and I look forward to part two.
That was former Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, Mike Vickers. I'm Michael Morrell. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is produced by Steve Dorsey with assistance from Ashley Berry and Sophia Rubin. Intelligence Matters is a production of Beacon Global Strategies.